House Judiciary to order. It's been a while, so it's nice having all you folks with us. It is now 12:34 p.m. It is Monday, March 14th in State Capitol Room 120, now known as the Grunberg Room. We have members present, Representative Mellett. We have Representative Christ Tompkins. Welcome, Representative Tompkins. You have big shoes to fill on this committee. Myself, Chairman Ledoux, and my Vice Chair, Representative Keller. I want to thank Christy Blair, the Judiciary Secretary, as well as Jessica Hanlon from the Juno LIO for the teleconference support. And before we begin today's meeting, I want to ask for a moment of silence for Representative Grunberg to honor his memory. Thank you. And I want to note that Representatives Klayman and Representatives Lynn have joined us, as well as Representative Foster. So today we are taking up House Bill 205, the Omnibus Criminal Justice Reform Bill. We have been waiting a long time for this bill, and I personally think that this bill is probably one of the most significant bills, certainly for House Judiciary and probably for the entire legislature this session. So this is Representative Mellett's bill, and to begin with, I would like to ask for a motion to adopt the CS as a working draft.
Madam Chair, I move you to adopt CS for House Bill 205, version H, as a working document.
Hearing no objection, we are going to adopt that as the working document. On Friday, members received hard copies of the Criminal Justice Commission's report, the CS for House Bill 205, and our tentative hearing schedule for House Bill 205. And on your desks, you should have copies of the sponsor statement, the sectional analysis, PowerPoint presentation, and a sectional that relates each commission recommendation to relevant sections of HB 205. This should be particularly helpful as we proceed with today's meeting. So I would like to begin by asking Representative Mellett to introduce the bill.
Thank you, Chair Ledoux. First and foremost, there's a lot of thank yous to go around, so I want to recognize it. Although it has my name on as the sponsor, this was really crafted by the Criminal Justice Reinvestment Group and by Representative Keller and Senator Coghill, with a great amount of help from Jordan and my staff, Grace Abbott, who has been working tirelessly with hopefully all of your staff on this piece of legislation. It really is a shift for us here in the Judiciary Committee to look at some of these recommendations and put them on paper and make them reasonable and make them really work towards what we would all like to see is less Alaskans in prison. We recognize right now that there's a problem with our criminal justice system, and with the increase in prison population by 27% over a decade, we need to look at our criminal justice system and look at how we deal with Alaskans who have committed crimes and how we can rehabilitate them and invest in them so they don't re-offend and end up back in our prisons. And by that happening, the increase in corrections and increase in the corrections budget and ultimately having to build another prison in just a few years. So a year ago, the legislature, along with the governor and the court system, asked for help and from the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, and I think each one of you have on your desks and are available for the public are the 21 recommendations that came out of that. And I think, Representative Keller, you played an intricate part. You should probably be speaking to some of this, too. And so they did. They delivered a package of recommendations, and that is what this bill is based off of, those recommendations. And it it's a developed package, and it's the key goals are implementing an evidence-based pretrial practice, focus on prison beds, on serious and violent offenders. We look at who we have in our prison population right now, and we have from folks that have victimized, not victimized people, misdemeanors, people that have parole violations, it runs the gamut. And so what this bill also is trying to do is strengthen the probation and the parole supervision. I think that's one of the things that I was, when I read the report, became really clear to me. The other thing that stood out to me was that when folks get out of prison, they head back to prison within 1 year. And why is that? Well, that was one of the things in the commission report, looking at ways of successful reentry back into the population. They're Alaskans. We want them to rehabilitate. We want them to go back in society and not reoffend. And so if you look at some of the opportunities in this piece of legislation, we would gain a lot of savings if we could make that come to fruition. So I think with that, Representative Keller, if you want to add anything to it, this has been a really truly hard work and dedication by yourself and by Senator Coghill and by the commission members. I think we've come up with a suite of ideas and a suite of solutions that, while we might not all agree on what this looks like, we need to start the conversation. I think this piece of legislation is a great place to start. And I think this committee, its diligence and looking at each aspect of the recommendations and each aspect of the sectional, looking back at how that reflects on what this Judiciary Committee wants to see as a final product. I'm going to say I really I'm going to miss Representative Groenberg through this process. I had many spirited debates with Representative Groenberg about this bill and about portions of this bill, and he had so graciously offered to help carry it on the floor, and I will miss him for that, because he had a depth of knowledge that no one can compare to, and his passion for the subject. So with a little bit of heartache today, I'm glad to see Representative Chris Thompson's here, and I know Max is looking down at us right now, and at moments in time, I'm sure many of us will channel some of his questions and some of his attitudes towards a perfect bill. So with that, Madam Chair, thank you. My staff, Grace Abbott, was going to do a great job of walking through the sectional with her lifelines and hearing from the commission. Taking this bill piece by piece and really having some good conversations, we are going to have a rewrite of our criminal justice system and opportunities for reinvestment that are meaningful to people and to keep Alaskans out of jail.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Representative Keller, would you like to add something here?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Miller, for giving me a chance. You said it all very well. There's just a couple things I'd like to emphasize. You referenced the people that worked on it. It was really an impressive group, and there was commitment and buy-in by everybody involved. There were several judges. I'm going to miss somebody because I'm just doing this off the top of my head. But the prosecutors are there, defense was there, Quinlan was there. And then the we had corrections, of course, and the attorney general was involved, and the Judicial Council, of course, they're the ones that administered. They were engaged really well, and mental health was there. Like I said, I'm going to leave some out, but the point I'm making is there was many meetings, and they were always there, working on this. It was really good. And the other thing I wanted to, you said it, but I just wanted to acknowledge them, too, because their expertise in the areas that they're in far surpass anything I could contribute to the bill. I was there, but, as a layman. The other thing is just to emphasize that it's a justice reform, but it's justice reinvestment is what we refer to it as, and that's because there's money to be saved. And you're right, there's problems. One of the things that appalls me, is a part of the population increase in the Corrections Institute is pretrial. You know, more and more pretrial lockups, and just dealing with that administratively, we can do a lot there. So, yeah, there's the other thing is that it's not the kind of bill that, let's say, if it all works out and we pass this, I think it's currently a 104-page bill now in the Senate. If we pass this, it's not going to be across the finish line. It is just a step. It's a maintenance process that is ongoing. The council is ongoing, and there's lots of work to do. So it doesn't solve all the problems, but it sure makes a good start. But thank you. I said way more than I thought I was going to say.
Thank you, Representative Keller. And this is the first meeting that we've had without Representative Grunberg, and it hardly seems real that we are conducting a Judiciary Committee meeting without him. But we hope that he will be channeling not the rabbit hole questions, but some of the really, really good and insightful questions that he always had. We have testifying today. We have Lieutenant Chris Sell, we have Brenda Stanfield, and we have Greg Razzo. Greg is online. Lieutenant Seng, I believe, is here in the room. And Brenda Stanfield, I think, is online. And what I'm going to ask you folks to do is to hold your questions until the end. And we also have with us to answer questions, we have John Skidmore from the Department of Law Criminal Division, Jeff Edwards, Executive Director of the Parole Board, Carrie Belden, Director of Probation and Parole, Department of Corrections, Claire Sullivan, Deputy Commissioner of Institutions, Department of Corrections, and Alyssa Wooden, Department of Health and Social Services. So there are plenty of people to answer questions along with Lieutenant Sell, Ms. Stanfield, and Mr. Razzo. But I would ask you to hold the questions until we get to the end of this presentation. Representative Landon.
Yes, I'd just like to make an opening comment. This is a very, very important bill. It affects a lot of people. The major overall concern that I have about it is an omnibus bill. It's kind of a laundry list of everything in the justice system, and it concerns me that we might like one portion of this bill, but not like some other portion of the bill, and I'd hate to see it go down in flames because of not liking one thing. That's why, personally, I would prefer the thing broken into a few separate bills rather than the omnibus bill, but this is what we got. We're going to work with it to try to do our best, come up with a good final product, but it does concern me that it covers such a breadth of things that not liking one section could hurt us in another section. So let's hear the bill and see what we have to say.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. All right, could I have Chris Seng and Lieutenant Seng and Brenda Stanfield join us, as well as Greg Razzo, who is online. And does everybody want to... First person who is going to begin, please start by identifying yourself for the record and tell us who you're with. And as people pop up to testify, please follow that line of identifying yourself. Thank you.
Sure. My name is Chris Sell, and my day job is that I'm a lieutenant at the Juneau Police Department. I am also the vice president of the Alaska Peace Officers Association. However, I do want to make it clear that I'm not here to speak for either JPD or APOA. I'm here to speak as a member of the commission. As a matter of fact, there's great controversy about this bill in law enforcement, and I may not get invited to some picnics this summer. So it's been a difficult process for law enforcement, and me included. So I'd like to open by describing the commission process and a little bit of my journey through that other people have told me is helpful. So the commission was made up of people who don't usually get together in the same room in a non-adversarial sense. It was attorneys, judges, a defense attorney, law enforcement, victims' rights representatives, normally people who meet in a rather confrontational environment. This time we were put in a room together. I had been nominated for the commission by a friend who won't identify themselves, so there's that. So I found myself on this commission, and originally, as we started to talk about things between all these various parties who don't usually get together, I have to admit, and I'm not proud of this, that about for the first year on the commission, I mentally had my arms crossed over my chest the entire time because I didn't want anybody out of jail. I engaged in some chest bumping, figuratively, of course, with Senator Dyson, Quinlan Steiner, who's a defense attorney who's in the room, because sometimes we talked about things I just didn't like. And I had to come to grips with where is that coming from. And I became aware of politics when the tough-on-crime speeches were all happening. Does everyone here remember the tough-on-crime speeches? Those were awesome speeches. Lots of people got elected over that. Let's be tough on crime. I mean, even at 13, that just sounded so obvious that we should be tough on crime. I continued to believe in that, and I became a police officer because I wanted to be tough on crime. I wanted to protect people, and I would risk myself to do it. And I really, I guess in my heart of hearts, thought the only criminal you can trust is one that's in prison. And it was a pretty hardened view. But then we started looking at the studies, and we started looking at the science of corrections. And it made sense with things I had seen in the field that when I was arresting the same person over and over and over again, they were becoming more antisocial, more detached from the community, and more dangerous to me and the other officers who were working in the streets. So I could see the disenfranchising that was happening as people went through the system. And I saw people beg for help with drug and alcohol problems and mental health and want to go into the system and not getting help in the system because that's not what corrections was doing. And as I walked through the jails, I saw people taking naps and watching TV and playing cards. People that I knew had really serious problems, addiction problems, maybe not even literate and able to get a law-abiding job if they wanted to. Serious work needed to be done by people who were sitting around napping and watching TV rather than being confronted with the things that they needed to deal with to get better. So it was painful. It wasn't as painful as getting doused with bear spray last week. That was worse. And that's my new yardstick for all pain. So I will give you the doused with bear spray level of each recommendation if you would like to know my pain in dealing with it. But I had to start acknowledging that there was something to the science of corrections. Tough on crime worked really well for a while. It did. It brought down crime rates. And then the investment wasn't what we all thought it would be. You know, it's like Beanie Babies that we all thought were going to be worth a lot. And that investment wasn't working out. So we have to rethink those. And I had to rethink some things. And some of you may remember me testifying against making any drug possession a misdemeanor. I did that. And I have to admit, I still don't like that bill because it didn't have the reinvestment piece. And we had to be aware of if people are not in jail, then where? I am, I guess, too cynical or too educated to think you can just turn people loose and they're going to behave on their own necessarily. There needs to be something, if not jail, then something else. Some treatment, some supervision, something to help reintegrate the person back into law-abiding society, because many times just taking their word for it won't do it. So we get to the Criminal Justice Reinvestment Report, and I agree that maybe it isn't perfect. Maybe it does need some changes. When we finished this report, we weren't slapping each other on the back saying, boy, this is it. We have figured out everything and thought of everything. This is a massive work of legislation. This is huge, and it took us years to go through it. And not everybody was in the room. So we don't take that personally when there's adjustments to the bill. We did our hardest work, but we also know that there's a lot of good brains out there. But we did want to save enough money to make the reinvestment meaningful. And if I would have one caution in these tough economic times, and I know they're hard, do not adopt this bill without the reinvestment. Because if you do that and just shorten incarceration, you will take our current revolving door and just make it spin faster. And that won't be good for public safety, and it won't be good for any of us. So there has to be meaningful addressing of why people start engaging in crime. And that's what makes this bill work. So the first person I'd like to introduce is probably someone who had just about a tough a time as I did, uncrossing her arms from across her chest, because she was working with victims' rights, a very critical part. And also a tough group to meet their needs. So I'd like to yield the floor to Brenda, if she's there.
I am here in Fairbanks.
Thank you. Brenda, can you just begin by identifying yourself for the record?
Sure. I'm Brenda Stanfill, and I'm here today as a commissioner with the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. Also, my day job, I work with the Interior Alaska Center for Nonviolent Living here in Fairbanks, and I don't necessarily speak for them, but my board strongly supports my involvement in this issue. So very honored to be a part of this. And as Chris said, yes, this was definitely a challenge to come in, kind of take away those preformed ideas and think about hearing what was being said and thinking about addressing those issues. One of the things that we were asked to do when we started this was to do a data-driven, evidence-based process. And a lot of the stuff we have done coming up to this have been based upon outrage, upset, things that didn't go right. And, you know, I say this all the time, and I'll say it again here, is that we tried to criminalize our way out of social issues. And from a victim advocate standpoint, we thought that would fix it. You know, if you take somebody out of this environment and you put them in jail, they're going to have this realization that they should do things different, and they're just going to do it. But I believe that what I've found over the years is that when people do this kind of behavior, it's not because they're just wanting to. It's because that's what they know, and a lot of times they don't know how to do it different. And so I will reiterate that as we're talking about this, and pretrial is going to be the thing that I talk about, we have to talk about the reinvestment portion, that this is not a budget savings bill. To me, this is a budget transfer bill. It's not about that we're going to save so much money. It's about we're going to save money on this side by doing something on this side, which in the long run is going to make us much safer in our communities and address public safety and ultimately less victimization. So that's how I came into this, and so I will share the subcommittee I was on was pretrial, and this is starting with the recommendations that the commission came out with, and I'm going to share a little bit of the data that we used when we came out of each recommendation, and let me know if there's anything that I'm not covering or that you can't hear. I can see you on the screen pretty well, though. So the first recommendation we had was expand the use of citations in place of arrest for lower-level nonviolent offenses. Now, there was already in the statute the ability to not arrest, but it's not something that's used very often. So this was changing a way around the way the law currently reads in order to make it where law enforcement had a greater ability to think through whether this person was a risk to public safety. And if they felt they were not a risk to public safety, they could decide to issue them a citation that gave them a court date instead of taking them to jail that night. The reason that we really looked at this one is that when we looked deeply into the data of Alaska, 76% of the pretrial admissions to prison were for misdemeanor charges. 56% of the pretrial admissions to prison were for nonviolent misdemeanor charges. And so that was really the focus, was these nonviolent misdemeanor charges. Could we do something different there? And plus 81% is the growth in our pretrial detainees over the last decade. So 81% in the last 10 years from what we were to where we are now. They also shared with us some national research, and that national research said that if you detain someone more than 24 hours, it can actually lead to worse outcomes than similar defendants who were not detained. So what they found is that if you take someone to jail and they lose their job, it could very much result in a worse outcome. So when law enforcement is arresting someone, looking at someone, they can actually look and see what's the best thing to do for this person in order to achieve public safety if recommendation number one is adopted. This will create a presumption of citation for misdemeanors and Class C felonies, excluding persons offenses, domestic violence offenses, violations of release of conditions, or offenses for which a warrant or summons has been ordered. Now, when the commission made this recommendation, the one thing we knew is that that was a high-level recommendation, and that now what we were going to do through the legislative process is work through those specifics of the presumption. And I think that you've seen a lot of work done on the Senate side to try to do what we called the carve-outs. We knew there would have to be some additional carve-outs, that the commission didn't have a list of every crime that was there in order to decide which ones should be carved out. And so we appreciate, from the victim advocacy standpoint, I appreciate the willingness of the legislature to really look at making sure that we make the presumptions be for those people who truly can be not arrested and not impact public safety. So recommendation number two, this was where we were going to utilize a risk-based release decision-making. So once again, when we put someone in jail, most of the time, it's based strictly upon how much money you have as to whether you get out of jail. So if you have someone who has committed a pretty high-level crime, but they have means, and next thing you know, they are able to bail out, we haven't necessarily looked to see if there are risks to our community. We've more looked to see, can they afford the bail schedule? Currently, there are bail schedules. If you're arrested for a drunk driving and you're taken to jail, you don't have to go before a judge. You can just put up however much money they say is that bail schedule, and you can be out of jail within the half hour or to the hour. We have a lot of crimes that meet that. Very few crimes actually require you to go see a judge before you can be let out of jail. This would make it where the release decision-making, once they have made a decision to arrest, would no longer be based upon just money. It would be based upon risk. The state of Alaska would need to come up with a risk assessment in order to decide who it is that's getting out and who's going to stay in jail. And that's going to be some work, but they gave us some good examples of things that have been done and that it appears we would have some technical assistance to help us do this. The recommendation that the commission gave also included a grid of which types of offenses would be let out on what's considered to be their own recognizance or which would be let out with different kinds of measures in place. One of the recommendations is that we go to a bond that is not cash, so you would have more of a performance bond where someone's agreeing to do certain things, but they're not actually having to put cash up front. However, there would be a cash collection at the back end of that if they violated that bail that they would then go after. And we did want them to actually, you'll see in number E, I'm not sure exactly what you have there, but one of the things that we wanted to do was authorize that the collections unit would garnish paychecks and permanent fund dividends to collect on those forfeited unsecured bonds and unpaid victims restitution. And this is a big piece of it, is that we can't just say you can get out of jail for free, but then if you violate, you know, there's no penalties. We definitely have to put something behind this. But this would allow people who are lower income to be able to get out of jail as long as they're not a risk to public safety. One of the things that was presented to us during this time was the disparity in ethnicity between who is able to make bail and who's not, and that was a study that was done by the Alaska Judicial Council showing that we did have disparity there. They also gave us some numbers there that 52% of defendants were never released during the pretrial period. And that was based on a case file review that the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission did. So 50% of people who have been picked up are staying in jail until they actually have a trial or they plead. They found also that the majority of the defendants in Alaska with bail of $500 or more are unable to pay it. So secured bail under $500, 36% were unable to post that bond. Secured bail between $500 and $1,000, 57% were unable to post the bond. And secured bail between $1,000 and $2,500, 62% were unable to post that bond. So it really, the money piece of it really does have an impact on whether someone can get out pre-trial. So going on to recommendation number three, we had recommended that they implement a meaningful pretrial supervision. And I stress the word meaningful. It's not that we're just letting people out of jail and then hoping they show back up, hoping they don't commit more crimes. Once this risk assessment would be done and that somebody would be put out, is that we would actually address those who need to have supervision in order to be successfully out in our public communities, and not just drop the ball there. So we would look and decide what was their risk level, and would things like having them do some kind of a 24/7 program, maybe the issue is drugs and alcohol related, if they could come in and blow, or maybe we can use the electronic monitoring that actually measures if you've got drugs or alcohol in your sweat, those kind of things, that there's a lot of technology out there we could use for pretrial supervision. This would require that we create a pretrial program, and so this is part of the reinvestment, is that none of this pretrial process works if we don't do the reinvestment into a pretrial system through Department of Corrections. A part of that meaningful pretrial supervision could be as simple as just directing the Alaska court system to issue court date reminders to criminal defendants. They've found that in other places that has had a tremendous impact on people showing up for their court dates. And this, again, we went back to the research when we were doing recommendation number three, and they found that restrictive release conditions like pretrial supervision lead to better outcomes for higher-risk defendants, but they lead to worse outcomes for lower-risk defendants. So we would really have to look at all the requirements. We don't want to do a one-size-fits-all in pretrial where everyone has to do electronic monitoring or everyone has to do drug testing, but that we actually craft this in a way that meets the needs of those that are coming out on pretrial to address public safety. Recommendation number four, this is where we wanted to focus supervision resources on high-risk defendants. We know that some people do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do, and it's a one-time thing. They're extremely remorseful. They go get maybe whatever necessarily help they need, or maybe they just have to stay sober for a while. Maybe there's, you know, I think we all can think of that one moment in time that we did something that, you know, for me, I was thankful there was no computers when I was 16 and nobody's tracking those things that I chose to do at an age that I wasn't thinking so clearly. So we do know that we've got youthful offenders. We have sometimes that people turn 18, 19, do something dumb. You know, we don't need to focus so many resources on folks who've got other things going on, and we need to be able to look at that. But we do need to focus those resources on our high-risk defendants. One of the things that was noted during the commission work is that as we have gotten more tools to be able to let people out of jail pretrial, instead of just using those as individual tools, we've tended to heap on top of one another. So we might require bond in addition to 24/7, in addition to a third party, and that all of these together has made it where people cannot get out of jail. So this would ask us to go back and look specifically at what we have to do in order to make sure that public safety is being addressed. This would restrict our third-party custodians to conditions where we really could not do a pretrial supervision. Maybe there's no supervision in that location, or there really is no other way to keep the, our public safe. And that might be in the case of a sexual offender, where it's not so much about knowing where the person's at, but you need to know who they're with. And a lot of times that would take that third-party eyes on them. And so this recommendation number four would really look at how to make sure that we were addressing the conditions that each person needed, Once again, it would go back to having to create that pretrial system to have those people who could come in and look at those, assess that. It would be based on a structured risk assessment that would then hook in specific recommendations for that defendant with it. One of the things that they looked at, again, when we were looking through here, going back to this being a very data-driven, evidence-based process that we did, 75% of defendants sampled with third-party custodian conditions were unable to meet their conditions and were never released during the pretrial period. So that's, again, looking specifically at Alaska. It's really hard for folks sometimes to find a third-party custodian, and some of that is their location, some of that is the people they know, maybe their background, so that can be a real challenge. Those are the four recommendations that specifically came out of pretrial. So I thank you for an opportunity to talk about those. And at the end, we'll still be here and more than ready for questions.
Thank you very much.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I believe Greg Grasso is up next.
Fantastic. Greg, are you here with us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. So please identify yourself for the record, and you can proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Greg Grasso. I work as a vice president at Cook Inlet Region Incorporated. Thanks to Siri for letting me spend the incredible amount of time that we've spent working with the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. I've been a lawyer for 31 years here in Alaska. I practiced law for 21 years in Kodiak, Alaska. I've known Representative Ledoux for almost all of that time.
All of it, Greg.
I think all of that time. And I can tell you that the work on this commission has been very difficult. It really has been very time-consuming in that we were required to go through just a tremendous amount of data. I should also add that I'm the chair of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. At the end of the day, there was a number of things that came out as drivers of the Alaska prison population and themes that we used throughout the various recommendations, I guess, that are supported by scientific evidence and that are actually contrary to a lot of what, you know, the average person would believe, and that goes to what Lieutenant Sell was talking about earlier. I'll tell you before I begin, probably one of the most striking things that occurred during the commission was in an attempt to have the commission do rural outreach. I'm the Alaska Native member of the commission, and I've been working with justice issues for Alaska Natives for many, many years now. And in conjunction with the Alaska Mental Health Trust back in November, we had a chance to visit Nome and Kotzebue. And while in Nome, the Commissioner of Corrections invited commissioners to go and tour the facility, Anvil Mountain Correctional Center. And then on the second day of the trip, we actually had a chance to go and meet with the prisoners in a town hall meeting. And at that, I was allowed to ask some questions. And my observations were that, you know, in going through the first day, I was almost ashamed to be there as an Alaska Native man. I walked through, and there were half a dozen cells, maybe eight cells, devoted strictly to people that were there for Title 47 offenses, for offenses that were not criminal at all. And those cells were mostly full. They were there for people that were a danger to themselves or others. We were treating mental health problems in our prison, we were doing that simply by locking people up. And then the next place we visited was the two mods inside the prison where the prisoners were locked up. And I have to tell you, I don't know what I was expecting, but when I saw that everybody in that prison was an Alaska Native person, with the exception of maybe two people, I saw maybe two non-Native faces in the crowd. I just couldn't believe it. And it's as Lieutenant So was talking about, you know, there were people playing cards and sleeping and watching TV. And these were people that were there for serious issues, or else they wouldn't be there. And they weren't dealing with anything other than killing some time in prison. And it just seemed to me to be a waste in so many respects, to have people that are potentially useful people just being warehoused in this zoo out in the woods. It was really striking to me. So those are the sorts of things that we were presented with the commission. We saw the people that were living in Nomenkotsavue, and I can tell you that Alaska has tremendous amounts of qualified people that are so under-resourced that they have the desire and the will to work with the population that is intoxicated, but they don't have the resources to do it. So at the town hall meeting, let me tell you about that one. That was pretty good. I had the chance to ask a question of the prisoners, and I asked, everybody that is here for an alcohol-related offense, would you please raise your hand? And everybody in the prison, but about six people, raised their hands. And then I asked, if you're here for a drug-related offense, would you raise your hand? And the other six people raised their hands. And, you know, there's a real simple conclusion to that story, that we have a addiction problem facing our state that is of such significance that it is costing us, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars in corrections, and we do very little to pay for the treatment of that problem. All right, going to the commission's recommendations. First of all, this was a significant project, and we spent a lot of time on it, but it's really the tip of the iceberg as much as it's an omnibus criminal reform bill. There were just so many issues that were not part of justice reinvestment that are still on the plate for the commission. We've been asked to take a look at all the Title IV offenses, the alcohol-related offenses that have criminal sanctions associated with them, the Title 28, the driving offenses, and the barriers to reentry, which is probably the most significant part of what the commission really needs to dig in on, and that's all of the barriers to reentry for people that are coming out of prison that can't drive, they can't get a job, they can't find treatment in the areas where they're from, and all of those things are still on our plate. So we're busy as we can be, and I'll make sure that we get to the end of that. All right. I know we have limited time. The recommendations in Recommendation 5 really point to the fact that the research shows that short jail stays do not reduce recidivism, that they do not reduce the chance of somebody reoffending compared to probation, and they can actually cause recidivism. Sending somebody to jail can actually make it more likely that they will become a criminal again. Compared to defendants sentenced to probation, individuals sentenced to short jail stays with probation have a significantly higher likelihood of future arrest and incarceration. Even when you control for other variables, the average crime increasing effect of jail remains statistically significant. So that is true as it applies to all of the recommendations in 5, A, B, D, and F, particularly with recommendation 5C, which is reclassifying first and second time theft offenses under $250 as non-jailable misdemeanors. Again, the research shows that jail stays don't reduce recidivism more than probation does and can increase it. In 2014, we looked at that as a benchmark year, and we noted that there were 324 offenders that were admitted to prison for theft in the fourth degree, which is the misdemeanor theft of theft under $50. More than half of those theft four offenders stole goods under $50. And offenders convicted of theft of less than $250 stayed for an average of 23 days behind bars post-conviction. So 23 days in jail, average stay for somebody that is convicted of a low-level misdemeanor theft crime, a crime that is not a violent crime. It's not particularly a dangerous crime, but we have a lot of people spending time in jail for low-level misdemeanor theft charges. Let's talk about misdemeanor admissions in general. 82% of prison admissions are misdemeanors. 82% of people that go to prison are misdemeanors. 60% of those prison admissions are nonviolent misdemeanors. So they're not all disorderly conduct and assault in the fourth degree. These are 60% nonviolent misdemeanors. And we have a very limited use of prison alternatives outside of probation. So what the commission has looked at is the alternatives that can be placed on somebody in addition to probation, in addition to community supervision. And that goes to things like electronic monitoring and the use of fines and other sanctions that don't cost as much as sending somebody to jail. And I hate to talk about cost because cost isn't the driver here. It was something that we were asked to take a look at, however. I'll refer you guys back in September of this year when we got a letter from the leadership of both the House and the Senate and then the governor the next day asking us to be sure that we took a look at what it would cost or what it would take to avert future prison growth, right? And then they asked us what it would take to avert future prison growth and reduce the prison population by 15 and 25%. So just to reduce future prison growth, that is 1,416 beds. 1,416. To reduce it by 15%, 2,180 beds. And to get to the 25% number, which is what we used in our report, almost 2,700 beds, 2,689 beds. So, I mean, we're talking about significant changes that need to come from these recommendations and from your work in your bill to try and accomplish this if we're going to actually see a reduction in Alaska's prison population. And, again, it has to be followed by reinvestment. So for the DWI offenders in 5E, the research for DUI offenders shows that jail sentences are associated with higher recidivism rates than prison alternatives, even when controlling for differences among offender groups. So a prison sentence, even a short sentence for a DUI offender, really has a higher chance of resulting in going back to jail again for doing it again. And this finding is consistent for offenders with multiple DUI convictions. So jail isn't a sanction that's working. So these days I'm a businessman, and I've been a businessman at Siri for 10 years now. And when I see a result that tells me that 2 out of 3 people coming out of prison go back to prison within 3 years, all I can tell you is we're not getting what we pay for. We're not getting reduction in public safety. We're just not. And we're not doing any corrections. We're not doing corrections in the corrections department. The best DUI responses emphasize replacement of jail time with low-cost monitoring programs, the use of community-based interventions like electronic monitoring and intensive probation provide better treatment results because the offender can learn to adjust their consumption within their normal living environment. Misdemeanor DUI offenses, offenders comprise nearly a quarter of all post-conviction admissions to prison in 2014. So we need to target misdemeanor DUI offenders. They come back to prison at a higher rate, and what we're doing doesn't work. Recommendation 6, defelonization of possession. So let me tell you what the research shows on this. Longer stays in prison, again, do not reduce recidivism more than shorter prison stays. There's no significant effect of longer prison stays on recidivism. So they look, and these are studies across multiple states, and they're what they call meta-studies, meta-analysis. So they take a look at a tremendous amount of data, and the fact of the matter is that sending somebody for a longer and longer term in prison by itself does nothing to reduce recidivism. Some studies find that severe punishments, such as felony convictions and prison terms, actually increase criminogenic effects, causing offenders to be more likely to commit crimes. And this is true for drug offenders. People are simply going into prison and staying longer. Admissions to prison post-conviction for felony drug offenses have increased by 52%, driven in large part by a 68% in simple possession of drugs in the fourth degree offenses. And felony drug offenders are spending 16% longer behind bars. I apologize for going through all of these statistics. There's percents here and percents there in almost everything I say. But I think the conclusion of all of these statistics is exactly what we're telling you, that the science simply does not support the way we're doing things right now. Research shows that states that classify drug possession as a misdemeanor have slightly lower rates of violent crime, property crime, and drug use than states that classify drug possession as a felony. 13 states plus the District of Columbia currently classify simple drug possession as a misdemeanor. So 13 other states have simple drug possession as a misdemeanor. It's something that Alaska really needs to consider. And, you know, I can tell you that I saw that revolving door every day in the Kodiak courthouse. I was a prosecutor and a defense attorney, and I was in that courtroom every day, usually doing misdemeanor-related crimes. And we would see, honestly, you know, the same, you know, 15 people coming through that court on a regular basis. They would go and do their time. They'd come back out. They would be drinking. They'd either be arrested for drinking or they'd be arrested for doing another minor crime, and then they come back in. And it was just incredible. And it turned out after you do it a half a dozen times, it starts to seem like a waste of time. And I think that's what we're trying to avoid here. So there is a recommendation about the revision of commercial drug offenses. This is one that really has caused a lot of concern, I think. But the idea here is that when you're a drug dealer, when a person is a drug dealer, there are usually two kinds of drug dealers. There's the kind that sell a quantity of drugs, a small quantity, to support their drug habit to their buddies. And then there's the kind that do it for money, the commercial people that are in the drug business, that are in it to make, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars. And so the defelonization or the demarcation of commercial drug offenses recommendation attempts to deal with that. Again, long prison sentences for commercial drug offenders have a low deterrent value. The chances of somebody actually being caught for selling drugs is 1 in 15,000. So whenever we're talking about drug transactions, there can be 15,000 before somebody actually gets caught. So the deterrence really isn't there. With such a low risk of detection, drug dealers are unlikely to be dissuaded by the remote possibility of a longer stay in prison. And longer stays in prison here, again, do not result in any result more than shorter stays. There's no significant effect of longer prison stays on recidivism rates. Some studies have shown that severe punishments, such as felony convictions and prison terms, may have criminogenic effects again. And this is especially true of drug offenders. So giving a drug offender a long sentence, the studies show that results in actually increased recidivism. Raising the felony theft threshold, recommendation 7, tying it to inflation. Here, there's absolutely no relationship between the value of the felony theft threshold and whether a person's going to steal. So the evidence is pretty clear about that states that have gone to a $2,500 theft threshold or left it there, they've actually states that have raised the felony theft threshold have actually seen reduction in some small amounts in the rate of theft. So it simply does not make an offender less likely to commit a crime by increasing the prison stay here. In Alaska, admissions to prison after conviction for theft in the second degree, which is the theft between $750 and $25,000, has grown by 52%. The research shows that nationwide, the felony theft threshold has no impact on property crime and larceny rates. So, recommendation 8, align non-sex presumptive ranges with prior presumptive terms. What we looked at here was a fairly interesting amount of data because in 2005, the Alaska Supreme Court issued a case called Blakely, Blakely versus State. And in the Blakely decision, the way that Alaska was doing presumptive sentencing was tossed out. And so the Alaska legislature, in an attempt to deal with that court decision, rather than giving a specific presumptive sentence, imposed a range of sentences. And when they changed the law, it wasn't with the idea of increasing the amount of time that people would stay in prison, but the effect, when we look back at 10 years, has actually been remarkable because that's exactly what happened by the change in the law in 2005. And our recommendations simply attempt to roll back the legislature's action so that we can at least get back to the way it was in 2005 and control this increase we see in the courts in long prison sentences. Again, because long prison sentences don't reduce recidivism any more than short prison sentences do. So since this shift in the legislature in 2005, the felony length of stay has increased by 31%. For the Class A felonies, the ones right below the very most serious classified or unclassified felonies, so for Class A felonies, they've gone up by 80% since 2005. Class B felonies have increased by 8%, and Class C felonies have increased by 17%. So, you know, we've really seen kind of exactly what the legislature didn't want to have happen by the change in the law in 2005, and we'll ask you to really take a hard look at this particular recommendation about sentencing. So I think I'm on recommendation 9. Which is expanding the use of discretionary parole. Am I getting into your stuff, Chris?
No, I won't speak until number 12, so you're fine.
Okay. So here we're talking about the use of discretionary parole. And what we found was that people actually weren't in prison, weren't applying for discretionary parole. And it was difficult to figure out why they weren't doing it other than they thought they just would be unsuccessful. But the research shows that longer prison stays do not reduce recidivism more than shorter prison stays. Let me see, where am I at? And that although a substantial number of offenders currently serving time in prison are eligible for discretionary parole, only a small percentage are applying and actually appearing before the parole board. So on any given month in 2014, an average of 462 inmates were eligible for discretionary parole, and an average of only 14.8 applied, and parole hearings were held. Recommendation number 10 is the geriatric inmate recommendation, and I think this is an obvious one as well. This is for offenders who have the potential to be paroled, be on probation at age 55. It simply costs a great deal of money to keep people in prison, at this age, and the chance of them reoffending is very, very small. The evidence shows that that these people simply do not reoffend at any significant rate. And this gives the legislature the option to take some action so that they can be considered for specialty parole. Researchers have found that, and this is consistently found, that age is one of the most significant predictions of criminality, with criminal or delinquent activity peaking in late adolescence and decreasing as people age. In Alaska, offenders released at age 55 and older were far less likely to be rearrested than the average for all offenders. The geriatric inmates are a costly population to incarcerate, and nationwide, prisons spend about 2 to 3 times more to incarcerate geriatric inmates than younger individuals. The number of offenders that are age 51 and older in Alaska's prisons has doubled in the past 10 years. It's the fastest growing age group. Our baby boom prison population is actually expanding as we would expect it to. In 2005, 410 offenders were age 51 and older. In 2014, that jumped to 833. Recommendation 11, incentivize completion of treatment for sex offenders with an earned time policy. Believe it or not, treatment of sex offenders works, and the evidence shows that. And this is a population that's really easy to hate on for very sound reasons. But we want this population, who ultimately is going to be coming out of prison, to not offend again. We want public safety and no more victims. And we don't do enough treatment in prison. If we did more treatment for this population, both in prison and then when they get out, and then have intense community supervision, then we think we will have a significant increase in public safety, less victims, and less recidivism. The research is pretty clear on this point. An Alaska Judicial Council study of recidivism in Alaska in 2008 and 2009 found that sex offenders had substantially lower rates of rearrest within 1 year than other offense groups. And the same study found that sex offenders were reconvicted for a new sex offense within 2 years at a rate of 2%. Sex offenders today are staying in prison 86% longer than they did 10 years ago. And that's because we've been tough on crime, on sex offenders. And the results are as you would expect. If we're going to increase the length of sentences, then we're going to see a lot of sex offenders in jail for a longer term. And we're just beginning to see the effects of the tough on crime on sex offenders. Right now, it's going to continue to increase for a number of years. And then Recommendation 12, graduated sanctions and incentives.
Now you're into my area, Greg. Sorry to cut you off.
Okay, go ahead. Thanks for interrupting me.
So now we're entering the community supervision section, and I'm going to go over recommendations 12 through 18. I will not have as many percentages as Chairman Razzo did. Quite frankly, he's just smarter. But I'll put my glasses on, so that'll make me look a little smarter. For number 12, we're talking about implementing graduated sanctions and incentives. And I talked about all of the problems people come into prison having. And the graduated sanctions and incentives could allow us to relentlessly address those problems and whether or not the subject is coping with those. And the encouragement is for swift, certain, and proportional responses. People with kids, I don't have any, they kind of scare me. Felons don't, kids do. Tell me that when you are raising a child, you can't tell them, you know, if you run off in the grocery store today, in 6 months, there is a possibility you won't get dessert for a month. That doesn't mean anything. Is that when you're trying to influence behavior at the very beginning of our lives, our behavior and the consequences have to be swift, certain, and proportional. And when I've talked to people who are addicted to drugs, they're thinking at most in 4-hour increments, because that's when they need to use again. And if you tell them you'd better not use, because if you do, in 6 months to a year, you may have to serve the rest of your sentence, that doesn't mean anything. And so the emphasis here is on swift, certain, and proportional sanctions, and allowing for both positive and negative sanctions. You wouldn't be able to influence your child's behavior very well if all you did was negative punishments. Nothing positive, no congratulations, no rewards of any sort. That's just limiting the toolbox. Incarceration is only one tool in the toolbox, and we are trying to add additional tools to that for the graduated sanctions and incentives. So this would require a lot of work on the part of the Department of Corrections, who I find staffed by really good people who really want to make a difference and who know their jobs and know the people that they're caring for in the Department of Corrections, if we would just give them enough resources to have more tools to influence that behavior. The next recommendation, number 13, is capping technical violation stays, and this is part of the swift, certain, and proportional consequences. If you do something that you shouldn't be doing, there's going to be a consequence and then another consequence, and then the consequences are going to continue to ratchet up. Now, I know officers, and I sympathize that it's frustrating for us to get taunted by a felon on the PACE program who says, yeah, I made a mistake, I'll see you in 3 days. That can have an emotional reaction, but the fact is that swift, certain, and proportional sanctions and sanctions that happen immediately have to be better than random severe sanctions. It just doesn't make sense that leaving everything up to chance wouldn't encourage people to gamble with what the outcome might be when they violate their probation. Next, we go to probation earned credit, and this is part of the positive sanctions, is that if you comply with your probation, if you do the things that you're supposed to do, you can earn compliance credits, because we have to have some positive tools to use as well as only negative. All of the studies have shown that people respond best if there's positive rewards that can be involved in a system. And people who are checking in with the court to say that they're doing okay, you watch bloom in court when they get to say, I had 30 days where I didn't do anything that was prohibited. I have been off drugs or alcohol for 30 days. And there is a pride in that. And this helps us establish a sense of pride and hope, because the common denominator I find from people who are not doing well with incarceration in our current criminal justice system is that they all have a lack of hope. That's the most common characteristic of people who are failing in the system. So for the next area that we're looking at, number 15, maximum probation terms. Ooh, this was about a 3 on the bear spray scale. I struggled with this, but the science is clear that for the most part, people will violate their probation in the first year, and that recidivism usually happens really front-loaded to getting out of jail, and that your dollar becomes less productive the longer the person is on probation and you're putting that effort into supervision. So this was a difficult one for me. It is counterintuitive, and I understand that, but the science, I had to let supersede that instinct. Next, we have good time on electronic monitoring. Now, I saw in a movie once where electronic monitoring can also have a zapping effect for negative feedback, but I don't think that's real. The electronic monitoring we are talking about is the traditional electronic monitoring, and even if the zapping electronic monitoring existed, I seriously doubt the defense attorney on the commission would have let me get through with that. So What we're looking at is electronic monitoring is one of the things that, if not prison, then where? If not jail, then where? Electronic monitoring is working with people while they try and maintain their jobs and maintain their family commitments and do the things that are protective factors for them rejoining the community as a productive member, and yet doesn't just trust them to behave, because I don't trust anybody to just behave after almost 19 years in law enforcement. So this is an alternative, and you can also turn that into a positive incentive where you get good time for behaving yourself on electronic monitoring. It's the extension of that tool. So we want to see an increase in electronic monitoring and good time associated with it. The next one I'll cover is recommendation 18. I'm skipping over the one that's not in the bill. I assumed that that's what you would want. And the recommendations?
It actually is in this version.
Oh, it is in this version of the bill. Okay, my notes are old.
Grace,
so,
can you speak? Please identify yourself for the court reporter.
Pardon me. For the record, Grace Abbott, staff to Representative Millett.
For the record, it's me again, Chris Sill. And what we had talked about at the commission level was the treatment resources for alcohol treatment. Alcohol is overwhelmingly the substance abuse drug of choice that fills up our prisons. And we really struggle with this, and we find that there's not enough resources in our alcohol treatment, and there's not enough alcohol treatment available for people who are ready to take that step of getting off alcohol. So we wanted to increase the resources with alcohol and provide some direction on who we're sending to alcohol court. There had been times, I understand, that even people addicted to drugs had been sent to the alcohol treatment because we didn't have a more appropriate place to put them. So we wanted to look at the offense categories that would be associated with the alcohol programs. In our next area, we're looking at the halfway houses, or CRCs. These are commonly known as halfway houses. So we wanted to make these more effective by continuing the treatment. I'd like you to consider the treatment as being a continuum through the incarceration, arrest and incarceration, that when you're arrested, there's a risk assessment done that identifies your criminal drivers, and those are addressed throughout the incarceration and as you transfer into the community, as you essentially practice being a law-abiding citizen with some supervision. And really, the last step of that practice is often the halfway house. And we'd like to improve those outcomes by having treatment there, because we know that it's not a 30-day and done proposition when you're talking about getting somebody off drugs or off alcohol or managing a mental health disorder or two or three of those factors. So we want to have the treatment available in the halfway house. Make sure that contracted halfway houses are meeting those obligations, and having an admission criteria that puts the resources where the risk is. We also know that when we mix high-risk and low-risk offenders in the same halfway house, the high-risk offenders teach criminal behavior to the low-risk offenders. For some reason, it doesn't work the other way around. But it's the high-risk offenders causing problems with the low-risk offenders, in essence recruiting them to a criminal lifestyle. So we would like halfway houses to minimize that. That then takes us to some oversight and crime victim recommendations. And I'd understood that Brenda was going to address those. Brenda, are you still here?
I am. Thank you. Once again, for the record, Brenda Stanfill, Commissioner for the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. So recommendation 19, one of the things about all of this work that we're doing, what we didn't want to do is just base it upon some statistics that we read from other states and from other things that happened, but not have our own way to measure whether it was having the same effect on Alaska. In Alaska, we tend to have a lot of things that other states don't. They don't have systems that are so far disconnected in those things. We also have a consolidated jail system that many don't have. A lot of have a prison versus community jail. So we needed to make sure that what we're doing is working. And so Recommendation 19 requires the collection of key performance measures and establishes an oversight council. I've heard Lieutenant Sell say, I'm not necessarily saying that I want three more years, but you do already have a criminal justice commission that is set up and has been, is very invested in what's being done, and it would make sense to make sure that that oversight council stays in place, whether that be the criminal justice commission or another one. But there does need to be someone who's coming together regularly, collecting those key performance measures, and making modifications. We also know that this is the first step in this process, and we expect that we would be coming back and saying this part worked, this part maybe didn't work, and making modifications through the legislature and statute as we went. Recommendation number 20 addresses that modification area. So what Recommendation 20 is saying, sometimes what we do is a bit of a knee-jerk reaction based upon something that happened. And Recommendation 20 requires that if we are going to increase sentences or make a change, that there would actually need to be a 10-year physical impact done where we would know for sure what impact that's going to have, or a pretty much for sure what impact that's going to have on our prison growth and the population. And last one I want to talk about, and while Recommendation 21, coming from the victim services hat, Recommendation 21 is definitely not the last of the recommendations or one that can be done without. I don't think any of this can be done, or I don't think any of this is even being done without having victims and victims' rights and victims at the forefront. The ultimate goal of this is that we get better recidivism rates, we get lower people, less people committing crimes where we have less victims. So one of the recommendations is that we advance victims, crime victims' priorities. And the way that they came up with these crime victim priorities, we hosted two roundtables, one in Fairbanks, one in Bethel. We invited people from throughout the state that work with victims. We invited victims themselves to talk one-on-one or in the group if they would like. We went out and got a lot of information and research that we pulled together, and we were assisted by Ann Seymour, who's a national victim rights advocate who also works with Pew and was able to help us pull those together. Excuse me. In addition, the Office of Victims' Rights, we've had a lot of interaction with Stop Valley Thieves through the Senate side of it. We've had the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault feed in. Mothers Against Drunk Driving was at the meeting. So just a lot of representation throughout our state to think about what it is, what are our gaps. And so you can see that there was recommendations that were proposed that were specifically about things we could do through the statutes. And some of those, they wanted to, district attorney's office should make enhanced efforts to increase the number of crime victims signed up for court notifications through Vine. You know, some of these are not hard ones, but they're hard to figure out how to do. You know, is that we have just a general number and we hand it to them? Do we sign it up there at the time that they're at the district attorney's office? But these are things we needed to make a focused effort to do better, because ultimately they lead to much better outcomes for victims. One of the things that I believe DOC has already started is reviewing and revising policies and procedures related to inmate phone calls. I've heard that with this new system that they have to pay for, it's much harder for them to reach out and call people they shouldn't be calling. So I believe that you have these recommendations on the victim crime priority, and I haven't looked exactly at the bill that you have in front of you to see how it's tied in. I do, though, that a lot of them can be done through regulations and don't have to be done through statutes. But one of the things that is not specifically in this recommendation 21 but tied right into recommendation 21 was the fact of the reinvestment priorities. And for me, this is where I get excited about this bill, is that, you know, it's scary for me as a victim rights advocate, as a working with crime victims for 20 years. It's scary to me to think of letting people out of jail. I still have a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction, even though I've seen all the data. I think, oh no, you know, what are we going to do? But ultimately, I have a true belief that if we keep somebody in jail 30 days, or we keep somebody in jail 45 days, I heard somebody give a number the other day. It was like $210,000 per day for you know, basically in 5 days it's cost $1 million to keep folks in jail for this little 3-day period of time, did we really get $1 million worth of additional benefit? Which, if we could take that $1 million and actually put it into prevention efforts, you know, I believe that there's a victimization study out there from comparing 2010 to 2015 that shows that $3 million investment in prevention that we did for 5 years in order to focus on domestic violence and sexual assaults and reducing victimization against women actually had an 8% decrease in victimization, which related to 3,000 less instances of victimization last year. That's a huge number. And so I think that's where we have to look at. None of this works to do anything better in our state unless we start looking at the reinvestment priorities. I believe that the reinvestment is, part of that is pretrial. Part of that needs to be prevention. We also need to look at how we're working with victim services in remote and bush communities. Transportation is a huge issue. Things like getting a sexual assault exam, getting out of the community in a way that your rights are still protected, your confidential rights. Access to treatment, I mean, we hear people all the time say, you know, the prime time for treatment is when something just happens. So you get arrested, you know you got a problem, you're ready to get help, but it's a 6-month wait, even to just get an assessment sometimes. So these are the things that we need to really look at when we're talking about reinvestment priority, and then making sure that when people get out of prison, they actually have reentry and support services. So we look forward to the next part of this bill that we believe is being crafted and will come out that really talks about how we're going to do reinvestment on the other side of this.
This is Chris Sell again. I was just going to back clean up a little bit now, and I promise it's only a few more minutes. Grace is going to be talking about some of the reinvestment suggestions that have been put into the bill, and maybe I can head off some of your questions or even what other officers have asked me, what were you thinking? So this is a what were you thinking section. So limited driver's licenses, sometimes when people get into trouble, they can't figure out how to navigate the system to get a driver's license back. Maybe they can't afford some of the restrictions, like having a breath test to start their car. And they end up just driving revoked and driving suspended all the time. We probably cite people for driving revoked and driving suspended based on a different crime every single day in Juneau, 2 or 3 times. So the limited driver's license, which is often necessary for people to maintain employment, especially when you get outside of communities that don't have public transportation or maybe they need to do shift work, that we'll allow them to live law-abiding lives instead of this stacking and steamrolling of offenses that can happen when you put a restriction on somebody that's contrary to their ability to make a living at all and support their families. We also talked about the administrative license revocation, that maybe if someone is not considered, is not found guilty, then the Department of Motor Vehicles currently takes their driver's license away anyway on DWIs. And, you know, maybe that's not appropriate. As you can tell, I'm really struggling to even spit that one out. Can you tell how hard that is? That's about a 3 on the bear scale. So, But I do have to say there is a sense of justice. If you're not convicted, maybe the license shouldn't go with it, though I know lots and lots of people that are guilty and end up not getting convicted. But I learned to live with this one. With the food stamps, there's been lots of discussion about people who have committed felonies, should they ever get food stamps. And I understand the cynicism. I worked in the drug unit. I've seen texts where people were telling their dealer, I can buy drugs now because I just got my food stamps. And we know that they can be diverted, just like drugs to get people off heroin can be diverted. But then when you try and take a step back from being offended by the behavior of some, is denying people food really the way to get them to address their higher level problems? I'd like you to go back to your high school lessons about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If you don't have food and if you don't have shelter, do you really do things to make you more valuable to the community? So denying food is a tough one. I'm not sure we did that to change behavior as much as possibly making ourselves feel better because we punished somebody who was doing wrong. And maybe that's not the best motive. So we also have some ideas about the reentry program that, and I'll let Grace go into the details on that.
Sure, absolutely. Once again, for the record, Grace Abbott, staff to Representative Millett. The reentry program is a concept, and I'll go over this later in the sectional, but it's a concept as to how to direct the Department of Corrections to help people better navigate the outside world once they're released, truly to reenter the community, truly to become, you know, functioning, contributing members of our community again, and that it requires the Department of Corrections to help reentering inmates come up with a plan and instruct them on resources available in the community for things like getting state identification back. So some of these would perhaps fall under the food and shelter requirements, but are certainly helpful in helping people come back into our communities.
And the final suggestion, community work service.
Please identify yourself just for the
I'm sorry.
Court reporter.
This is Chris Sell again. To talk a little bit about community work service, lots and lots of offenders get ordered into community work service, especially low-level offenders. And when they don't do their community work service, they end up going back to jail for certain periods. And I think that's overly generous of us. I don't think we should house them and have them watch TV and take naps for not doing their community work service. We can convert that to a fine, which would save us money and has the potential to bring in money rather than continually spend it on someone who hasn't met that low-level obligation. So there is a consequence, but I don't think costing us $141 a day is the right consequence currently. So I'd like to see that changed. Thank you. I believe I'm done.
Thank you. Grace, do you have additional presentation before you get into the sectional?
Representative Ledoux, once again, this is Grace Abbott, staff to Representative Millett. I don't have additional presentation, but I have a beast of a sectional to go through.
All
with
right.
You.
Well, I think probably it makes sense before you get into the sectional that this would be a good time to start asking questions because we've got a lot of people still online that might answer some of those questions, as well as I think, well, you obviously are here, Lieutenant Sell, and I think we still have Mr. Razzo and Brenda Stanfield on the line. So do we have
turn on the lights here so we can see?
Pardon me?
Well, turn on the lights.
Good idea.
I've been in the dark much of my life.
So do we have any questions for anybody?
I have a couple.
Okay. Why don't you begin, Representative Klayman?
And I'm confused about who was speaking to Recommendation 18. So I'll ask the question that relates to Recommendation 18 and the community rehabilitation centers. That's also the place in which we, if we're looking for ways to more effectively use those community rehabilitation centers for pretrial release and also have them get sentencing credit for what they do in pretrial release treatment programs. That's part of that Recommendation 18.
Lieutenant Sam, do you want to just come back up here and join us? Because I'm sure some of the questions are going to be directed at you.
Don't leave.
This is Chris Sell again for the record, and we're talking about Recommendation 18.
Yes.
And I'm sorry, what could you articulate the question again?
Well, one of the topics we've had some discussion at different times in the last year on this committee has had to the question of pretrial release and the whole question of sentencing credit for pretrial release in different programs. And my general understanding is that the Recommendation 18 is where we also want to look at how those programs that people are getting released to pretrial are also playing into this whole kind of dynamic of trying to improve the effectiveness of the community rehabilitation programs.
Sure.
Being able to help with the reducing recidivism and everything else.
So are you asking if someone is, for example, released pretrial to a treatment program,
right,
might that treatment program reside in a halfway house? Is that what you're asking, or have I totally misunderstood?
No, you haven't misunderstood through the chair. No, it's more that there's halfway houses which are technically run by the Department of Corrections, but there's also rehabilitation centers like in Anchorage, the Clitheroe Center.
Correct.
That are not run by Department of Corrections, but people will often get released there pretrial and ultimately be seeking sentencing credit for the time they are in that rehab program. And so I'm just asking, in this area of Recommendation 18, is that where we would look to see where the proposed omnibus bill will address some of those questions?
Certainly. There is Section B, you'll see, adopting quality assurance procedures to ensure that CRCs are meeting contractual obligations. Obviously, this is a reference to the non-DOC halfway houses with regard to safety and offender management. So treatment definitely could play into that. You may also address such issues as mixing high-risk and low-risk offenders, because you wouldn't want to mix pretrial high-risk and low-risk any more than you would people who have already been released from a prison.
Okay. And then a different area, if I can.
Go ahead.
Okay. Lieutenant, so you were talking a lot about your concerns with driver's licenses. And
yeah.
It seems like there's kind of two competing issues going on, or maybe three. One is that you have many people who have committed criminal offenses, and some of those may involve alcohol and driving, and part of the risk of people losing their license entirely is that they lose their ability to go to work. And so how do we try to balance this interest in not having people driving intoxicated and having a penalty for having done so in terms of you really can't drive, and at the same time recognizing that if they don't go to work, that creates a whole other set of problems.
And I think that's something that can be addressed under the limited driver's license, that currently it's addressed under temporary driver's license. Even after somebody's arrested for the first 10 days, they can apply for a hearing and ask to be able to drive to work, ask for limited access, so that we at least give them an option to be law-abiding instead of the constantly racking up driving revoked, driving suspended charges.
And then the last follow-up question with regard to the administrator revocation, unfortunately common per experience of those who are charged with DWI is they show up in court and they do all these things, and then they start getting these letters from DMV saying how the license is being administratively revoked. And I think from the law enforcement side, I share your favor the fact that you like that administrative revocation, because some people who probably were driving while intoxicated are able to find technical ways to get around the criminal charge, and they usually don't really follow carefully enough on the administrative charge and they get their license revoked anyway. But from the offender standpoint and trying to help people not get completely lost in the system, that dual system of criminal charges and administrative charges that aren't following the same track and that they're not listening to each other is, I think, incredibly confusing to the public. And I think that's one of the reasons that this
sure.
is one of the recommendations, is kind of how do mm-hmm. people navigate it with some degree of certainty.
Madam
and
Chair?
Please forgive my hesitation. As a famous jurist once said, our system is designed to let 9 guilty people go free rather than wrongly convict 1 innocent person. And when you stand on the front lines of watching that happen, sometimes you feel like, okay, now that I've got my hand around your throat, I'm not letting go. And getting over that is a tough journey. So thank you for your patience.
And I'd follow up, I'm not entirely clear that's the quote I'd heard from that jurist that you're talking about, but I won't correct.
Any further questions? Representative Keller.
It's a question for you, Madam Chair. Would you consider bringing up Jordan Schilling and Ken Truitt, who are staff to Senator Coghill and myself? And frankly, they were in the trenches with the commission probably more than both of us were. and just with the idea of asking them if they have something that we were weak on in the presentation of the bill. And I don't have anything specific in mind at all, but if you would consider that, I'll do it too.
Certainly, if they would like to come up and join us or wait until somebody has something specific. But I believe they're in the room, and I believe they can be quite helpful.
Madam Chair, Jordan Schilling, staff of Senator Cockhill.
Madam Chair, Ken Truitt, staff of Representative Keller.
And Madam Chair, Representative Keller, I actually didn't have anything specific. I was just listening.
Jordan, that's great, because that way she knows we weren't passing notes back and forth. It was just an honest inspiration. Yeah.
So did you have anything that you wanted to add, Mr. Truitt?
Madam Chair, I would just say that working, and I'm sure Jordan would concur with this, working as staff to the legislative representatives to the commission, the commissioners, it was surprising and heartening to see the broad spectrum of interests that were at the commission and how well they worked together, specifically your defense side, working with your law enforcement side. It was really encouraging to see and to witness and be a part of, and the professionalism that every member brought was also very heartening to see and observe and be a part of.
Thank you. And if you folks will remain in the room in case something specific comes up that we might want to ask you, that would be great.
Thank you.
So why don't you come back up here, Grace, and Chris, if you could come back up and see if there are any further questions for you or Brenda or Greg.
I'm sorry, this is Lieutenant Chris Sell again. There's also another commission member in the room whose name may have been taken in vain several times. Quinlan Steiner is the defense attorney who is also in the room, if that's helpful for questions.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Christ Tompkins, did you have a question?
Yeah, a few, Madam Chair, if I may.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I don't really know where to start, so a lot of my questions are going to be with different members of the commission as I try to grapple this learning curve like a rock climber.
And we also, just to remind people, we have a number of people online, and then we've got Jordan, and we've got Ken Truitt, and so there are just a number of people. And then Doug Gardner from Ledger Legal has joined us now also. And we've got Jeff Jesse here in the audience, who was also on the commission. So welcome.
Wonderful. Thank you. A couple of the bigger points that I marked down as we were going through the recommendations, I thought I'd ask in committee. And one was, I'm not sure surprised is the right word, but impressed and noted in Recommendation 9, the comment that sex offender treatment is highly successful statistically and per the research. And I was wondering if you could expound on what those methods are and if that sort of success in reducing recidivism or reviolation is how it relates to other sort of classes of criminality.
I'm going to defer to another commission member. I understand the science and have deferred to the
science. Could you identify yourself?
I'm Chris Sell.
Sorry.
And I've spent a good portion of my career hunting sex offenders, and it's hard for me, and I think someone else can articulate it better, even though I've deferred to the science of the matter.
Now, who's going to address that then?
For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Cockhill. I don't have my notes in front of me, but I can kind of wing this here. So sex offender treatment is proven to be effective. We know that for a couple of reasons. First, the Washington State Policy Institute has done a cost-benefit analysis on sex offender treatment, and it shows that for every dollar we spend on sex offender treatment, we get a very good return for that money, and I can get you some research on that. Basically, sex offenders in Alaska have a lower recidivism rate than most cohorts of offenders. The Alaska Judicial Council did a study showing that the recidivism rate for sex offenders is 18%, and then the recidivism rate for repeat sex offense is about 2%. It's a very arduous program. It's the longest, most difficult program in the DOC has. It takes 18 to 30 months to complete. Not everyone does complete it, and so in order to incentivize that treatment, knowing that it is effective, the commission recommended a credit for sex offenders to complete that program.
So can I interject something here? So, Jordan, there are various types of sex offenders. There is the 18-year-old who might be charged with statutory rape with a 15-year-old. But there's also the 18 or the 25 or 45-year-old who may be charged with having sex with a 2 or 3-year-old. Those are very different, in my opinion, crimes. Is your analysis for both of those areas? Because what I guess I've heard the research is that folks who are with the 2 and 3 year olds, that those people can never be rehabilitated.
Madam Chair, the recidivism numbers that I was just citing, I believe they apply to sex offenders across the board. I can see if the commission has data specific on the different types of offenses. But you're right, sex offenses cover a very broad spectrum. Some are kind of the Romeo-Juliet scenario that you just cited, and some are incredibly heinous acts that many feel those individuals can't be rehabilitated. So I'd be happy to get more information for you on that.
I really would like more information on that particular area.
And if I could add to the policy as the commission recommended, it didn't differentiate between the two poles, between the two extremes. They recommended a very pure policy with the understanding that the legislature would probably take a hard look at it and scrutinize that.
And I would really like to see the statistics between those two types, because I think that's pretty important.
Yep.
Thank you. Continue.
A follow-up on that point. So we've got a treatment program that seems to work really well for a certain class of offense. And I was wondering if for other classes of criminal offenses, why there aren't treatment programs, or if there are treatment programs that we just don't happen to be using that have similarly sort of successful statistical outcomes in reducing recidivism or recommitting criminal activity.
Through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins, the DOC has a variety of programming. It's not just sex offender treatment. They also have substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment. I don't know what proportion of the budget, of DOC's budget, consists of treatment, but the research that I've seen shows that it works. The Department of Corrections did a recidivism study a few years ago showing that substance abuse treatment reduced recidivism by 21%. So it's effective, and the more we use it, the better. But it's important to know that we can't, with our current fiscal climate, it's very difficult to reinvest in things like treatment if we can't find savings in other areas. In other words, we need to quit spending so much on things that the research shows doesn't work and start spending it on things that we know do work, like treatment.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
I want to be conservative in questions I ask in respect to being the new kid on the committee and also having a lot to learn about the subject matter. But just as sort of a private citizen before I ended up with this gig, I was really fascinated with the concept of social impact bonds that basically tie treatments that will have long-term savings with basically creating sort of an alignment of fiscal incentives. And I was wondering if the commission explores social impact bonds and their use in Rikers Island, New York, or other jurisdictions in the United States.
Through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins, the commission didn't specifically talk about social impact bonds. I happen to know that they're having success in New York with them. The commission was very outcome-focused, as those bonds are, but they didn't specifically talk about those.
I think one last question will do me for now. In recommendation 10, it was noted that the geriatric sort of population within the prisons is there was some exciting statistic. It's the fastest growing population or cohort within the prison population or something along those lines. Is that attributable to people who are younger just being tagged with longer prison term, so they end up being old in prison, or is that because more people who are old are getting arrested and therefore ending up in prison. What's the sort of source of that statistic?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins. Really, it's because the legislature has increased sentences across the board, whether it be low-level felonies or high-level felonies. So that is why we see a stacking up in our older prisoners. We have a very graying prison population. They cost 2 to 3 times as much as most inmates, and yet we know that they're the least likely to commit crimes. They have the lowest recidivism rate of other cohorts of offenders. So I would say it's really because we've increased sex offenses, we've increased the sentences for A felonies, B felonies, and C felonies all across the board.
Thank you. Representative Klayman, you have a question, but one thing I should note, I think that we should try to direct the questions preferably to the commissioners, because we're not going to have the commissioners here at all of our sections, and then if they want to defer to Jordan or Ken or Grace, who will be with us more often, I think that would probably be the best way to go. We thank you for your testimony, Jordan. Representative Klayman.
Just a follow-up on, actually, Madam Chair, your query about kind of distinguishing between different sex crimes. And I think part of that also rubric in the kind of the what we would call the statutory rape situation and the sexual abuse of a minor that really appears quite egregious. I also think there's a real distinction in the statute between the sexual abuse of a minor offenses and the sexual assault offenses, which tend to be more less involving youth and more involving adults, and kind of how those break down in terms of the treatment and how successful treatment can be. My general sense, I think somewhat similar to the chair, is that people that are involved that are adult on adult sexual assaults, those especially the people that have more than one sexual assault on their record, their ability to rehabilitate are really tend to be quite poor, somewhat similar to what the chair senses. But in terms of a lot of the sexual abuse of a minor offenses, they're kind of the teenagers involved with kind of young teenager situations is very, very different than a 50-year-old and a 5-year-old, and how those two different classes of or types of offenses really, and the people involved, I would be very interested in what that research shows. That doesn't really require an answer.
I believe Mr. Schilling said that he would provide us with some research.
Right. And he did. I just was trying to get add a little more detail in the research. I'd be curious to see.
Thank you. Any further Representative Christ Tompkins? And maybe Chris could come back up and join us here.
I think the chief would like me to return to JPD at some point.
We like you here. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this relates to recommendation 2, which I think Lieutenant Sell was on your sort of side of the ledger, if I remember correctly. And specifically with creating a matrix of sort of risk and creating risk scores for pretrial release. A couple questions. Is this based on something that's been done in another state? And second question is, what are some examples of risk criteria that might be considered?
I can help you with the first part of that question, and then I'll have to ask for some assistance. Fortunately, we have some of the people from Pew here who helped with the research, who may have that at their fingertips, and I'm sure are furiously going through information right now. So I'll draw out the first part of that question while they look that up. But it is based on experiences in other states. We didn't make up anything. We did not get that original. We wanted to use tactics that had been used in other states so that we could see how they'd been impacted, how those states had used those. So it did come from other states. We would be looking at a risk assessment tool that's already being used and potentially altering that is as it's applied in Alaska, because it might be a little bit different. But other states using risk assessment tools are basically everybody who has done a major criminal justice reformation. Georgia, South Dakota, Kentucky, Mississippi, to name just a handful of the states who've already done this. And a risk assessment tool has really been a cornerstone in all of those states that have achieved anywhere from 9% to 21% savings in their incarceration costs. So do you mind if I defer to Pew at this point?
Go right ahead. Do we have somebody from Pew here? And I should have acknowledged you already. I apologize for that.
Through the chair, my name is Terry Schuster. I'm from the Pew Charitable Trusts. The Pew Trust provided nonpartisan data analysis and technical assistance to the Criminal Justice Commission. The question about pretrial risk assessment and what is it based on, or what is predictive of pretrial failure. There are two types of failure that are measured. One is failure to appear for court hearings. The other is new criminal activity during that pretrial period between when someone is arrested and when they are found guilty or not guilty. It is generally a short period of time, and so most people during that short period of time do not fail. So pretrial failure rates are pretty low, which makes them a little bit hard to predict. The things that are predictive tend to be static factors, things that don't change that you can find in someone's criminal history or court records. So if someone has, for example, prior failures to appear in court, they are likely to fail to appear again. So that would make them higher risk, or they'd get sort of some extra weight attached to the fact that they had prior failures to appear. Different jurisdictions will do a study to try to take a look at who is failing pretrial, who is committing new criminal activity pretrial, who is failing to appear for their hearings, and what do they have in common. And those things will be different jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And so the idea behind creating a risk assessment tool is to take data that is local here in Alaska and try to identify what is it here that might be predictive of pretrial failure, and then build a risk tool around that. They tend to look different jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And once you have created one, then you have to validate it year after year to make sure it continues to be predictive.
Acknowledging, if I may, Madam Chair, acknowledging that these risk factors differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, can you give us some examples of risk factors that were identified in another jurisdiction, such as Mississippi or Georgia or South Dakota?
Sure, and just to correct the record, I actually don't think all of those states do have pretrial risk assessment tools. So there's more than one type of risk assessment tool, so there's also the types that are measuring risk of long-term recidivism, which is a much longer time period. And so something that might be predictive of recidivism over multiple years might not be predictive of pretrial failure. So in some other states, there are factors related to if somebody has a prior certain type of offense. So a prior theft offense, for example, in some jurisdictions may be predictive of pretrial failure. If somebody has, I don't know all of them off the top of my head. I'm sorry about that. There are some places where there is an interview with a defendant to try to get some kind of social history, see if they have ties to the community. In some places, ties to the community is predictive of pretrial success, and others it hasn't been found to be predictive of pretrial success. It's actually a very hard question to answer on the spot without looking at sort of a data set. Sorry about that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Well, actually, I've got a couple of questions then. DUIs. Is it the idea to eliminate the automatic 3 days for the first offense?
My understanding is not necessarily. To identify myself, I'm Chris Sill. Maybe Grace can also speak to this, but when we talked about not having the administrative revocation. It was in the context of a case being dismissed or a person not being prosecuted for that or found not guilty. But Grace, do you want to?
To the chair, this is Grace Abbott, staff representative Millett. And the goal is not to eliminate that at all. Administrative revocations, like Lieutenant Sell mentioned, would refer to only people who the court has decided deserves their license back. All that it does is it allows the two branches of government to communicate and for the DMV to offer the license back.
No, I'm not talking about in the context of license revocation, but I think on the section of on DUIs, I thought that you mentioned that for minor offenses that jail didn't work. So I was just wondering whether it was in this bill to eliminate the 3 days for your first DUI offense.
And to the chair, the goal would be to encourage electronic monitoring in those cases.
So I guess I just have one comment here. Back in the days when I lived in Kodiak and maybe drank a little bit more than I do now and would drink with other young professional people, I mean, the idea of actually going to jail for 3 days, as opposed to, I mean, maybe getting something on your record, but, I mean, actually going to jail. That sort of humiliation actually did deter a lot of people that, I mean, I know I'm speaking anecdotally, from actually having that last drink before or taking the cab. Representative Millett.
On that point, Representative Ledoux, I think that was a deterrent, but I also think the deterrent of licensure. So if you're on a restricted licensure, which I think is one of the options that we have, that's also something to be feared because there's a lot of jobs that you can't have a restricted license, whether it's because of a DUI or some other infraction. So I think there's still the fear of having a limited license, and we can go through the whole limited versus restricted conversation because I think we've done that here in this committee before. But I think there's that is still part of the DUI process.
But I guess one of the things we were talking about here is that when it comes to licenses, we don't want to do things that make people lose their job. Anyway, I'm just mentioning that.
And Madam Chairman, if I may, this is Chris Sell again from the Commission. I understand exactly what you're saying. I'm not sure that getting your name in the paper plus having an ankle monitor on for 3 days would necessarily be a lot more fun than going to the halfway house where a lot of DWIs are served now over weekends so that people's employment is not compromised. So I respect the fact that you are on the minority of people that go to jail, the 20% that are actually thinking about cause and effect at the time they would be making those decisions. But I think we can leave other consequences in place. I don't ever want a first DWI to be painless. But I think we can maybe address that for less than $142 a day.
Thank you.
Madam.
Go ahead, Representative Timing.
Just, I think in answer to your chair's question, I'm just flipping through the bill again as fast as I can. I don't believe there's any proposed changes to Title 28 and removing the 3-day mandatory minimum. And I think even today that if you're convicted of driving while intoxicated and you're sent to the 3-day mandatory minimum, I think even today some people are being sentenced to house arrest on an electronic monitor for the 3 days. I think that's true today. And even those that don't go on house arrest are generally serving it in halfway houses rather than lockup facilities, especially first-timers. And in terms of the work management, having represented one person that's trying to manage that, the 3-day sentence is pretty manageable with a job.
Thank you. Representative Lynn?
I guess I'm not an expert on this. I'm a little surprised. I always had the concept 3 days in jail meant 3 days incarcerated behind the bars rather than an ankle monitor or some halfway house where you can basically relax some. So you don't actually, typically, you don't actually go behind bars. You probably are going to go to your halfway house. Is that ankle monitor or whatever? Is that correct?
Yes.
Better than anyone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender of the state of Alaska. The options do exist currently for serving your mandatory 3 days, not in a prison setting. It could be on electronic monitoring or in a halfway house. Also, DOC has the option to place you on electronic monitoring or a halfway house, but it also can be set up in advance. So it tends to get set up in advance if you have money in the facilities to do that. I do think the penalties, even though it's not specifically a jail sentence where you're in a corrections facility, are fairly significant penalties. The costs are extremely high. The restrictions on your license can be dramatic and can have an influence on your future employment, and in fact can often end somebody's employment. Some of these initiatives that have been discussed about the license and limited license and access will allow people to sort of meet the conditions of their probation and sentence to promote their own rehabilitation while maintaining their employment. Employment is a significant factor for future recidivism, and the lack of it is one of the things we found.
Thank you. Go ahead, Representative Lynn.
Now, is that the prerogative of the judge, I suppose, to send you to behind bars as compared to some kind of a halfway house, or is that statute, or is it regulation, or just the prerogative of the judge?
Through the chair, the judge will just set the sentence. The statutes guide how it can be served, and that could be permissible now under the statute to obtain your sentence through electronic monitoring or corrections has its own regulations and permissive scheme.
So I actually have a couple of more questions myself. Not sure who to ask this one to. I think we still. I see that Chris just left the room. Maybe Greg can answer this question. Greg, are you still online?
Yes, I am.
Was there anyone who'd ever served time and then maybe got somewhat rehabilitated on this commission? Pardon me?
Are we holding confessions here? Or?
No, we're not holding confessions. The idea that somebody who's actually been through the system might have had something valuable to offer.
I don't think that fact ever came up, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Keller.
Greg, just for the record, it did come up, but we realized it was kind of like after the fact, but also the difficulties and the obvious, the logistics of it and just making it work. It was too late once we got rolling, and most of us, I think, especially the legislators, have a steady stream of letters from inmates, and some of them quite articulate, and some of them with some real interesting points that they make. So,
thank you, Representative Keller.
I would say
geriatric inmates. I think that it was mentioned how much money that geriatric inmates were costing, and I'm not actually sure who to pose this question to.
The Pew expert is a good one.
Is the Pew expert here?
And DOC.
So, but my real question is, if somebody's served, like, let's say, 25 years in prison, and we're just letting them out when they turn 50s, and they probably, because this reinvestment wasn't in effect while they were doing their sentence. Is it actually going to cost any less? Because once they're out on the street again, they're going to need medical care. They're not probably going to have much in the way of job skills. Not that I'm suggesting that the cost by itself is a reason to keep somebody who's not going to do it again in prison, but I guess I'm just wondering, as a cost-saving measure, whether it actually is a cost-saving measure.
Madam Chair, my name is Terry Schuster from the Pew Charitable Trusts. This is a difficult question. I think here are a few things to think about. Some of the costs of incarceration for anyone who's incarcerated are room and board, food, everyday housing, paying for the heat, paying for, you know, these sort of everyday costs of operating a facility where someone's or some group of people is going to live. If someone is incarcerated constitutionally, you have to pay for all their medical care that is necessary. And so when someone gets cancer in prison, the state pays for their cancer treatment. When somebody has liver failure or any number of, you know, high blood pressure, any number of health issues, no matter what their age, the state will have to pay for it as long as they're incarcerated. These types of health issues are seen a lot more in inmates who are over the age of 50, over the age of 60, and those costs really start stacking up. When those groups of inmates are released into the community, they almost always qualify for Medicaid and or Medicare. And so a lot of those costs are still paid for by a combination of state and federal dollars, but a lot of it is covered by federal dollars. The difference is their everyday sort of housing costs and the costs of staffing them and having them under 24/7 supervision are not being paid. So that $142 a day, which is a largely sort of staffing cost, is not being spent in the community. With regard to transition back to the community and job skills and reentry, and can people who have been incarcerated for long periods of time actually reenter and be successful, it's hard. A lot of people who have been incarcerated for a long period of time don't have strong family connections anymore who are willing to take them back in. The part of the reentry planning that the commission has been talking about, that the Department of Corrections has been doing on their own aside from the commission, is trying to individualize a reentry plan for each person. And so some people who sort of each individual who's reentering the community needs to come up with their own kind of plan and needs to identify what are their needs that are going to help them have long-term success in the community. And so in order for people to really do well when they get out and have long-term success, they actually need to come up with an individualized plan. And there are reinvestment is a big area where we're talking about reentry supports and services. How do you sort of get someone to a reentry center and connect them with the services that they need, and how do you pay for that? And you pay for that partly by finding the money elsewhere.
Now, I understand about the cost of housing. I was just suggesting that whether we're paying for cancer treatment or liver failure or heart disease or anything that one might end up with after a certain age, that there's probably a good chance that we're going to be paying for it when they're on the outside also. Representative Lent.
Yes, help me understand, please. I believe it's age 65 you can get Medicare. I call it geezer care, but you get Medicare. Do you not get, if you are incarcerated, when you reach age 65, are you still treated by the state, or do you get Medicare? Because you're 65 wherever you are, whether you're in prison or whether you're on the outside. And then, of course, the same question would apply to Medicaid.
Right.
Help me. If you are incarcerated and you reach that 65th birthday, do you then qualify for Medicare like everybody else?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, eligibility for Medicaid and Medicare is suspended as long as people are incarcerated. And so if someone otherwise qualifies for either of those, Medicaid or Medicare, as long as they are in prison, they their eligibility is suspended and their health care is not paid for by those revenue sources. There is one exception, which I believe is if someone is hospitalized outside of a prison setting and they're there for more than 24 hours, then they that service can be paid for by Medicaid and Medicare revenue.
I was under the understanding that with Medicaid expansion that it would include prisoners, but maybe I...
It does.
Representative Miller?
If I might, I think I can throw some clarity on that, but it is the... yes, Medicaid expansion does cover prisoners when they're in the hospital. They have to be not incarcerated, so that they take them out when they actually travel to a hospital, and they and then Medicaid can pick it up. But yeah,
thank you, Representative Keller. Representative Lynn, I think you wanted to continue.
Well, just a couple more, or just actually one more. So if you're outside the prison with Medicare, then you know you're different than the average, and you commit a crime when you over Medicare age. When you go into prison, then do you lose the Medicare at that time?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, yes, you do. You lose your eligibility, and then your health care, the state is in sort of self-insured, where everyone who is in state prison facilities is has health care provided by state health care providers. There are sort of contract medical services in the state, and all the prescriptions are paid for by the state and not by Medicare.
But and
through the chair.
Through the chair. Can't remember what the question was now. I'll ask it later if I think of it.
So, do we have any further questions for any of the commissioners before we let Grace get into the sectional analysis? And we only have 30 minutes here before the next committee meeting begins. All right.
Okay.
Could I identify yourself for the record again?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the record. My name is Grace Abbott, staff to Representative Millett. And I don't know if the committee's interest is that I just go until we run out of time okay, fantastic. All right. The way that we've structured the sectional is perhaps easiest understood through the visual aid provided, which is the grid I believe you have in front of you, which exactly, the colorful grid with the recommendations and then their associated sections. I think of that as sort of the GPS for the bill, based on the fact that so many of these policies touch different parts of our statutes. Sometimes it's easiest to understand that way. That's also the way I hope to go through the sectional, is by recommendation and then to list the associated sections. So beginning at the top in the section associated with pretrial, the first recommendation dealt with citation versus arrest. This starts in section 42 of the bill, which establishes a presumption to cite and summons to court for nonviolent misdemeanors and Class C felonies, with exceptions including significant danger to self or others and specified crimes. For infractions or violations, this provides that a peace officer, may bring the person before a judge if the violation is for a violation of conditions of release, or VCOR, or for disorderly conduct. It continues in section 43, which forbids civil action for damages for failure to comply with this section. Section 44, which reduces the minimum duration when issued a citation before the first appearance from 5 days to 2 days. Section 45 requires that a notice to appear is at least 5 working days after the issuance of citation. This moves on to recommendation 2, which deals with risk-based release decision-making. In Section 41, this decreases the time with which an arrested person appears before the court from 48 to 24 hours and bars hearings from taking place 48 hours after an arrest. Section 46, which conforms renumbered statutes. Section 47, which requires judicial review and reconsideration of the conditions of release for instances where the defendant is detained pretrial due to those conditions, unless the judicial officer finds that less restrictive release conditions cannot reasonably ensure the appearance of the person in court and the safety of the victim, other persons, and the community. Section 48 moves on to allow for the defendant's inability to pay to be considered as a factor at bail review hearings. It specifies that a defendant may only receive 1 bail review hearing for new information relating to the person's inability to pay. Section 49 conforms to the creation of a pretrial services office, authorizing a pretrial services officer to arrest a person without a warrant for violating a court order. Section 50 directs the appearance to occur within 24 hours after a person's arrest, absent compelling circumstances. Section 51 limits judicial discretion to detain low and moderate risk pretrial defendants charged with nonviolent, non-DUI misdemeanors, and low risk pretrial defendants charged with nonviolent, non-DUI Class C felonies. This section prevents the use of secured monetary bond for low risk defendants while ensuring conditions can be imposed to require defendants to refrain from alcohol consumption, to avoid all contact with victims, and to keep regular contact with a pretrial services officer. In determining the conditions of release, the court shall consider the conditions of release recommended by the pretrial services officer and the person's pretrial risk assessment score. Section 52 creates a presumption of release on personal recognizance or unsecured bond with appropriate release conditions for low-risk defenders and for most nonviolent misdemeanor and Class C felony defendants who are not included in Section 54. The court can overcome this presumption and order partially or fully secured money bond if it finds on the record that no less restrictive conditions can reasonably assure court appearance and public safety. Section 53 conforms to the creation of a pretrial services office, authorizing a pretrial services officer to search a person's residence for the presence of alcohol under conditions to refrain from alcohol. Section 54 conforms to the creation of a pretrial services office, authorizing a pretrial services officer to search a person's residence for the presence of a controlled substance under conditions to refrain from consuming controlled substances. A judicial officer may order a defendant to participate in a random drug testing program with testing to occur at least once a week or random drug testing by the pretrial services division. Section 56 restricts the ability of third-party custodian release conditions in cases in which pretrial supervision is not available, secured money bond has not been ordered, and no other combination of release conditions can reasonably assure court appearance and public safety. Section 57 changes the restrictions on people who are eligible to serve as third-party custodians to prohibit those who are likely to be called as witnesses, as opposed to those who may be called as witnesses. Section 63 authorizes the Department of Law to garnish a permanent fund dividend to collect restitution ordered by the court. And Section 142 conforms to ensure that forfeiture of an appearance or performance bond is not exempted from permanent fund dividend garnishment. We move on to recommendations 3 and 4, which we've joined together here for the purposes of the sectional analysis. This is pretrial supervision of high-risk offenders. That's what we're talking about here. This begins in Section 99, which establishes the pretrial services program. So this is a new program, a new division at the Department of Corrections to conduct pretrial risk assessments, make recommendations to the court regarding release decisions, and supervise pretrial defendants who are released. This directs the commissioner of the Department of Corrections to adopt a risk assessment tool and relevant training and regulations. Additionally, this outlines the duties of pretrial services officers to conduct pretrial risk assessments, make recommendations to the court regarding release and conditions of release, and provide supervision for defendants released pretrial. This authorizes pretrial services officers to make pretrial diversion recommendations and to arrest defendants who have failed to appear or violated their release conditions. Once again, this requires pretrial services officers to recommend release on personal recognizance or unsecured bond for nonviolent, non-domestic violence, misdemeanor, and Class C felony charges, low or moderate risk DUI charges, and other low risk charges with limited options for departing from this requirement if the pretrial services officer does in fact find that no combination of non-monetary conditions can reasonably ensure court appearance and public safety. In Section 152, which amends Court Rule 38 of the Alaska Rules of Criminal Procedure, and this requires hearing reminders for defendants, which was one of the low-cost, high-impact changes recommended by the Commission. This moves on to now the sentencing section of the recommendations, which begins in Recommendation 5 related to misdemeanors. In Section 13, this reclassifies the crime of disregard of a highway obstruction to a violation punishable by up to $1,000 of a fine. In Section 22, this is conforming language to reclassifying several elements of the crime of failure to appear as a violation punishable by a fine of up to $1,000. Section 23 conforms failure to appear penalties to no longer be a Class C felony. Section 24 reestablishes the punishment of failure to appear as a Class A misdemeanor to apply to defendants missing a scheduled hearing to avoid prosecution or to defendants not making contact with the court within 30 days after not appearing at a scheduled hearing. Failure to appear is also deemed a violation punishable by a fine up to $1,000. Pardon me. This goes on to Section 25. Which conforms to the reclassification of the crime of violation of condition of release to a violation. Section 26, which reclassifies the crime of violation of condition of release to a violation punishable by a fine up to $1,000. Section 27, which is a conforming section. Section 28, which also conforms disorderly conduct penalty to be no longer than 10 days. Section 29 reclassifies the crime of attending an exhibition of fighting animals as a violation for the second offense, maintains a third and subsequent offenses as a Class A misdemeanor. Section 30 conforms to the reclassification of a crime of obstruction of highways to a violation. Section 31 reclassifies the crime of obstruction of highways to a violation punishable by a fine of up to $1,000. Section 32 reclassifies the crime of unlawful gambling to a violation punishable by a fine up to $1,000. Section 79 provides for a presumptive range of 0 to 30 days for Class A misdemeanors, excepting offenses with mandatory minimums above 30 days, or if the conviction is for a crime of assault in the fourth degree involving domestic violence. This allows the presumptive range to be overcome if the prosecution proves that the conduct constituting the offense was the most serious included in the definition of the offense, or the defendant has passed criminal convictions similar in nature to the offense in question, so if there's a pattern of behavior. Section 80 truncates the maximum term of imprisonment for a Class B misdemeanor to 10 days. Section 81 provides that for a person convicted of theft in the fourth degree, concealment of merchandise, removal of identification marks, unlawful possession, issuing a bad check, or criminal simulation, the court may not impose a sentence of more than 5 days of suspended imprisonment and a term of probation of more than 6 months if the person has previously been convicted of two or more times for a similar theft-related offense. The court may not impose a sentence of active or suspended imprisonment if the person has not been previously convicted or has been previously convicted once of a theft-related offense. This also provides that the court may not impose a sentence of imprisonment of more than 24 hours for a person convicted of disorderly conduct. It additionally provides for a person convicted of misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fifth degree, which is AS 1170050, subsection A sub 4, or misconduct involving a controlled substance in the sixth degree, the court may not impose a sentence of active imprisonment unless the person has previously been convicted of a drug crime, and may not impose a sentence of suspended imprisonment greater than 30 days if the person has no prior convictions, no greater than 180 days if the person has been previously convicted of a drug crime. And it additionally provides that if the state seeks to establish a fact-based aggravating factor at sentencing, the factor must be established by clear and convincing evidence before the court sitting without a jury. If the state seeks to establish a law-based aggravating factor at sentencing, the factor must be presented to a trial jury and proved beyond a reasonable doubt unless the defendant waives trial by jury, stipulates to the existence of the factor, or consents to allow the court to establish the aggravator by clear and convincing evidence without a jury. Section 86 conforms to Section 87 by differentiating driving while license suspended offenses related to DUI license revocations and those unrelated to DUI license revocations. Section 87 reduces the mandatory minimum for second-time driving while license suspended offenders whose license revocation is related to DUI offenses to 10 days. This removes the mandatory minimum for first-time driving while license suspended offenders whose license revocation is related to DUI offenses, and it reduces the penalty for non-DUI-related driving while license suspended offenses from a misdemeanor to an infraction. Section 89 requires first-time DUI offenders to serve a mandatory term of electronic monitoring. If unavailable, imprisonment is determined by the department. Section 90 conforms to provisions requiring a fiscal analysis of legislation that causes an increase or decrease in the prison population. Section 92 requires first-time refusal to submit to a chemical test to serve a mandatory term of electronic monitoring. If unavailable, imprisonment is determined by the department. Section 93 conforms to the requirement that a municipality may not prescribe a greater penalty for a municipal ordinance than what is imposed for a state crime with comparable elements. Section 94 conforms to the requirement that a municipality may not prescribe a greater penalty for a municipal ordinance that is what is imposed for a
Grace,
state.
Grace, I'm going to interrupt you here.
Sure,
you
absolutely.
Mind, since we're kind of running low on time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm seeing that we do have this excellent sectional analysis that's already been written up. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering whether it might make some sense, rather than simply reading from what the various sections do, is there anything particular in here that you think we should be focusing on?
Representative Ledoux, and for the record, this is Grace Abbott, staff to Representative Millett. Obviously, I'm at the committee's beck and call. I can go over whatever you'd like. I would also maybe offer to you the opportunity to read this and then to mark sections in which there are questions for our subsequent deep dives into the specific recommendations and the specific sections within the report of 21 recommendations. Is that your discussion?
I think that sounds like an excellent idea. Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Abbott right now, or should we just hold these questions about specific sections until we get to those specific sections, and everybody can go home and read this at their leisure, and then we can grill you on this?
Madam Chair.
Representative Millett.
There are some changes that I think Representative Keller and I have looked at and that are going to be maybe policy, big policy calls that we're going to have to make. And those things, I think, will self-identify as you go through the sectional analysis. And they are some different ways of dealing with criminal procedure. And there's a couple of changes, statute changes that we're making that may be more controversial than others. And I'll just say probation, earned credit probation, and sex offender treatment program credit, and also the theft threshold. Those are some of the things that we've been seeing that have significant policy decisions that this body and the full legislature will have to make. But I think as you go through them and you reference back to the 21 recommendations, you'll see the ones that are going to give members more heartburn. And Lieutenant Sell said, cringeworthy. It's like when we talk about right on crime and talk about criminal activity, there's definitely going to be some pushback on those larger policy questions. So I think it's a good idea for us to kind of go over them.
Right now?
No. Go over them and come up with a list of questions. I think because I've got my own in my head, and I know Representative Keller has some, and there's also some questions that have arisen through the Senate through the Senate committee hearings that I'm watching in addition to ours. So I think it's a great idea for us just to take it home, have a little homework, and then maybe we could write down our questions, and then we could test Grace.
Come back in June, right?
Yeah.
Sounds good.
And actually have some started.
Representative Clayman?
I would just note, I took the time, as we've been discussing this, to compare the committee hearing schedule and compare that with the color-coded sequence of how these are grouped together, and there's a remarkable connection between the color codes and when we're going to hear different things. And even for somebody that, like me, that sometimes gets confused in the order of things, this I think is very helpful, and I think we don't need to hear the speed version, because we'll be looking in the details at each.
My twisted tongue thanks you.
but thank you, Grace. Well, it is 3:01, and so I'm going to remind the members that we are going to be focusing on pretrial policies on Wednesday. I want to thank all of the commissioners, Greg and Chris, who is no longer with us, and Ms. Stanfield, and Quinlan, and Terry, and anybody else that I might have missed for being here with us today. And with that, I am going to adjourn the meeting.